Thank you, Brother Richard. Once again, love and greetings from my wife, Sister Teresa, and from many brethren in the Los Angeles area. We are from the City of the Angels. We just have to confess there's more than one kind. Oh, okay. Everything is well. A good many years ago, there was a brother, Earl Fowler, and I'll tell a little bit about him. He was considered to be a Revelation student, not necessarily a scholar, though he did a good job on that, but a Revelation student. And back in Brother Russell's last days, he was studying Revelation, and he was being discouraged by a number of brethren, saying, "What's you trying to do, get ahead of that sermon?" But he said, I knew that a blessing was promised for one that read the words or heard the words of the prophecy, and of course, and keepeth the things written therein. So he continued to study Revelation. Among the things that he studied were Revelation chapter 14. That's the harvest chapter. And there we read about the harvest of two vines. The first vine is in verses 14 through 16. That's one paragraph. The second vine is verses 17 through 20. Looking at vine number one, "And I saw, and behold, a white cloud. And on the cloud I saw one sitting like unto a son of man, having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. And another angel came out from the temple, crying with a great voice to him that sitteth on the cloud, Send forth thy sickle and reap, for the hour to reap is come. For the harvest of the earth is ripe, and he that sitteth on the cloud cast his sickle upon the earth, and the earth was reaped." That's the first vine. It's the vine of the harvest of the earth. That's the vine that's taken up from the earth. But we come now to the second vine in verses 17 through 20. "And another angel came out from the temple, which is in heaven, he also having a sharp sickle. And another angel," this is a lot of angels, I know, "and another angel calleth out from the altar, he that hath authority over the fire, and he called with a great voice to him that hath the sharp sickle, saying, Send forth thy sharp sickle and gather the cluster of the vine of the earth." There's the second vine. This one is not the vine to be taken up, but it is the vine of the earth. "For her grapes are fully ripe. And the angel cast in his sickle into the earth and gathered the vine of the earth and cast it into the winepress, the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden without the city, and there came out blood from the winepress, even unto the bridles of the horses, as far as 1,600 furlongs." Now, some of you may have read the so-called seventh volume, The Finished Mystery, and it's pretty amusing, the interpretation given there. But it was some years later that Brother Fowler found an application for these verses. In his own personal life, he had in the 1920s had a falling out with Judge Rutherford, and there was a problem. Rutherford could not kick him and the other brethren out because the meeting was on Brother Fowler's property. So there's a case where the Watchtower withdrew from the Bible students. And as they began meeting together there, without the Rutherford contingent, the Elijah Voice Society came along. Now, in line of history, there was first the Standfast Movement, largely in the Pacific Northwest, although some in Milwaukee and in Minneapolis, Iowa. There were some. Some of them went out west to join others. The thought was that the harvest is ended, and not only is it unnecessary to do public witness work because the church is all sealed and there's nobody else allowed to come in, and so, as I say, it's not just unnecessary, was their thinking, but it would be totally wrong to do any public witness lest you invite somebody to a high calling that is no longer there. There's a fundamental difficulty with that, and that is, if the church has no mission at the present time, what is there to do? What is left except bickering and party infighting? There's a case where I think Seattle holds the record. There were at one point in time 11 classes of standfasts in Seattle. Now, one of the weaknesses of the standfasts was taken care of by a group that split from them, split out of them, called the Elijah Voice Society. They were out to get Gideon's 300. They still thought that the door of the high calling was now closed, but that a public witness work was necessary because the last couple of verses of Matthew never went out of date. And they asked Brother Fowler to go out as a pilgrim for them. And here was the problem. What shall I do? Here are the brethren who think that the door is open, and they continue pursuing it, and to the extent that they are able, they do public witness work. Here we have the other group doing public witness work, but they think that the door is closed. Now, what should I do? And he said, as I was thinking about it, and I was studying in these verses here, first we have the harvest of the vine of the earth, followed right away by the harvest of the... First, there's a harvest of the true vine, and it is followed by the harvest of the vine of the earth. And he said, as I was studying this, I realized I had my answer. The harvest of the true vine continues until we see in progress the harvest of the false vine, the false vine being cast into the winepress of God. Because in the 20s and the 30s, we do not see the harvest of the false vine being cast into the winepress. Therefore, we are still in the harvest of the true vine. And so, he said, I knew then to say no thank you to the Elijah Voice Society and to continue meeting with the brethren. In our study of Revelation, or whatever other book it may be, our purpose should be to get the guidance to do what we should do. And this afternoon we're going to try to look at what is applicable especially in our period in the harvest. Now, in 1 Corinthians 13:12, it does say, we see through a glass darkly. Well, that means that, no, we're not going to see everything crystal clear. Does that mean, therefore, that because we cannot see everything crystal clear, that we should sort of pass over the things that are less clear, like the prophecies concerning what's happening during the harvest and what we should do about it? And no, that would be a mistake. We see through a glass darkly, but we do see through it. We should be seeing something, if we possibly can. Now, the temptation is to say, you know, it's pretty risky to see prophecies, and especially to speak up as to what you think that the prophecies mean. And, yes, it is risky. And over the years, over 100 years, there's been a number of brethren who've been a bit red-faced for it. Not all, but some. Nevertheless, even the turtle makes progress only when he sticks his neck out. And I'm going to stick my neck out. Now, we get a framework for the gospel age in Joshua, the 6th chapter. And as we go to Joshua chapter 6, we notice that first the angel gives Joshua the instructions. And Joshua, what's the Greek form of the name Joshua? Jesus, that's exactly right. And Joshua, as the leader of the Lord's people, is aptly the type of Jesus Christ. Now then, there are 7 days in which they march around Jericho. Some people call it the siege of Jericho. Yeah, that's what it was. It was a siege, but it was a very short one. And how many times did they go around the city on the last day? They went once around each day for the first 6. How many on the last day? 7, that's right. Now, somebody went around Jericho with the army. Do you remember who they were? They were the priests, that's right. And how many priests? 7, that's right. You know, you guess 7 when you're talking about Jericho, and you're almost bound to be right. And so each was given a trumpet. And how many trumpets is that? Good. So we are given first 7 days to span the gospel age. But 7 times on the last day, and we've got lots of last day prophecies, don't we? 7 times on the last day divides the harvest into 7 periods of time. Now, just in case we have any question about it, if one watches the paragraphing, because there are some people who paragraph the 6th chapter of Joshua a little differently than others, but reasonably paragraphed, one finds that on the first day, Joshua rose early. And what does that mean, except that in the beginning of the gospel age, Jesus Christ rose from the dead. And then it says, and the priests took up the ark. Because with the resurrection and ascension of Jesus Christ, we have the beginning of the gospel age of the church, which is divided up into these 7 periods of time. We have the framework for understanding that the 7 trumpets then in Revelation span the gospel age. And the 7 messengers corresponding to the 7 priests, the 7 messengers, the 7 letters to the 7 periods of the church span the gospel age. But 7 times on the last day. Oh, yes, that gives us our framework then to understand the 7 last plagues covering the harvest of the gospel age. Now, somebody questions, well, is that the 7 last plagues in Exodus? The ones that are cut off, the ones that fall only upon the Egyptians and not upon the Israelites? Or is it the 7 last plagues in Revelation? And the answer to that is a simple yes, both. So what we will be interested in today is the division of the harvest into 7 periods of time. And so that I don't take too much time on that, I'll just review. The 7 plagues, 7 last plagues in the Exodus were flies, murrain, that's a disease that is fatal to the cattle, boils and blains on man and upon beast, hail with thunder and lightning and fire that ran along upon the ground, destroying crops, the 2 crops that had come up. And then locusts came probably about 50 days later and ate up the remaining 2 crops of Egypt. Then we have a plague of darkness, probably caused by volcanic ash. You don't want that stuff to get into your eyes. That's why they weren't able to go anywhere for 3 days. And then we have the plague of the death of the firstborn. Not the death of the firstborn of Israel, the heirs of the Lord's kingdom, but the death of the firstborn of Satan's kingdom, the heirs of Satan's kingdom, because when the kingdom of Satan is destroyed, there will be nothing else left to inherit, pictured then by the death of the firstborn or the heirs. Now, there is something we can notice about these seven last plagues here. Some of them are, they're all annoying, yes, but some of them are only annoying, and some of them are deadly. The murrain that killed the cattle is obviously a deadly plague. The flies were not. The boils and blains on man and upon beast, well, they may sure hurt, but it's not going to kill anybody. The hail that destroyed two of the crops of Egypt, that one's deadly. The locusts that destroyed the other two crops of Egypt, that's deadly. Darkness is not, but obviously the death of the firstborn is deadly. Corresponding in Revelation, the plague is poured forth on the earth, then on the sea, then on the rivers and the fountains of waters, the sun, the throne of the beast, the river Euphrates, that's the river that runs through Babylon, on which Babylon depended for its wealth, and the current diversion of the waters away from Babylon really doesn't make it a very hospitable climate, place to live. So it's virtually uninhabited still. And then the plague upon the air. I will suggest that from the time of our Lord's return and the command to the Jews to return to their land, that would be 1878 it began, that something happened. But the first destructive plague, the murrain that killed the cattle, I would suggest would correspond with World War I. The next plague was not destructive, as annoying as it was, be the worldwide depression. Next plague, destructive, that's the plague of the hail, and that would be World War II. I think anyone living in Dresden could relate to that almost literally. And then we have the plague of the locusts. It was a case where the east wind brought locusts into all the borders of Egypt. It missed the Goshen where the Lord's people dwelt, but it brought locusts into all the borders of Egypt. And then after they finished eating up the remaining two crops, the wheat and the spelt, then a mighty west wind comes and drives them all out of Egypt again. After World War II, I think we've seen this East versus West conflict, where the communists brought problems into all of the Western world. I do recall, even in my lifetime, hearing about what's going to happen if Italy, all of Italy, turns communist. Where's the Pope going to go? Ireland is Catholic, but they can't afford him. The America can afford him, but they're still predominantly Protestant, were at that time, and they don't want him. What was the Pope going to do? Where was the papacy to be moved? So this was a plague which was upon the throne of the beast, especially, and that was a result of the eastern wind, in this case the communist wind, blowing. But beginning in the 80s, the wind seems to have changed. And we had the fall of the Soviet Union, which is now the Soviet Disunion. And the next plague, that's a plague of darkness. It was darkness that could be felt, so much so that no man could move from his place for 3 days. And the river Euphrates drying up, that of which Babylon depended upon for its wealth, it would suggest that our next major world event will be a worldwide depression. When's it going to start? Tonight? Next year? Personally, I doubt it's quite that soon. But it might be 5 years. I doubt it'll be 10 years from now. But we will see. I have been wrong before. And I confess that when it came to the East versus West conflict and the mighty west wind coming and blowing the locusts all out again, I thought that was going to be a World War III that would do the job, but it wasn't. It was local civil unrest and revolts from inside that did the job and did it quite completely. Are we in the ending of this fifth of the seven last plagues? It could be. Will the West have a momentary victory over the Eastern Muslim radical element? I don't know, but I'm certainly watching. Or will the next thing that happens be the major depression? Well, I think this is what is going to come. That's where I'm sticking my neck out. And after that, there would seem to be only one thing left, and that would be the Armageddon plague. And after that, finally deliverance from this present evil world. The people will be delivered from Egypt, no longer under the influence of Pharaoh, but they go 3 days to get to the edge of the desert before Pharaoh pursues after them. That, of course, would represent the thousand-year kingdom of Christ, where Satan is bound completely out from under the influence of Pharaoh, Satan, until at the end of the 1,000 years, Satan is loosed for the final exam upon all the world. And then they do what they were called to do from the very beginning. They go 3 days' journey in the wilderness to serve the Lord their God. And so we see then that the Exodus from Egypt really has given us a picture of things from when Moses comes to Egypt at the beginning of the Gospel Age, Jesus, at his first advent. It takes us through the Gospel Age, through the seven last plagues of the Gospel Age, 3 days' journey, through the 1,000-year resurrection kingdom of Christ, through the little season, that's one more day to cross the sea, and then finally 3 days' journey in the wilderness to show for us the perfect ages of eternity. So the Exodus picture, or the Exodus type, is one that never ends in reality. Now then, the effects that this has had on each of these seven last plagues have had on Babylon. First thing, after the Lord returns, is the call goes out, I saw an angel come down out of heaven, and then cried with a loud voice, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. Our motivation for that should be that we be not partakers of her sins. Because coming out and continuing to partake of the sins does the Lord no good, and it does us no good. We come to World War I, and what happened? Well, it got rid of the remaining kings of Europe. I can still remember when I was in school, they told us, Kaiser Bill went up the hill to have a look at France, and Kaiser Bill came down the hill with bullets in his pants. And then we have the Depression. What did it do? It just about destroyed fundamentalism. Now, fundamentalism was supposed to be based on 5 fundamental doctrines, and if they'd stuck to the 5, that would have been pretty good. They picked 5 good ones. It seems to me it was original sin, the virgin birth of Jesus, and that somehow in his death he obtained a substitutionary atonement for sin, and there is something concerning the certainty of his return. I think I missed one thing somewhere, but those are the right issues. Unfortunately, Protestant tradition went along with it, and so with the fall of fundamentalism, Protestant tradition was pretty well wiped away during the 1930s. And the liberals held sway in the theological schools and seminaries. And then their idea was, we are evolving into a great society and have no more need of those old things like the Bible. But then along came World War II, And what happened to the war that ended all wars? Well, it didn't. And so the ancient liberalism of Harry Emerson Fosdick, it fell with World War II. The East versus West struggle, the communist problem, was a problem in this country, but a much greater problem in the Roman Catholic countries. And it has been devastating for the tradition of the Church of Rome. If the Depression is next, that will take care of the wealth of Rome and of the other denominations who put their trust in wealth. And Armageddon will get rid of the support of the people. And these things right here, the kings, the civil government support, fundamentalism, liberalism, the two theologies of Protestantism, then the two things that support the Roman Church, the tradition and the wealth, and then the support of the people, that's everything, isn't it? I have just about enough time to mention the effect concerning Israel. In the beginning here, the first period, which would be up to World War I, produced an invitation to the Jews to go back to their land. First possible in 1878, thanks to the outcome of the Congress of Berlin, and the Lord prepared it so that Benjamin Disraeli, Benjamin the Israelite, was Prime Minister of England, I think starting in 1874. And he played a great role so that Turkey was compelled to agree that anyone now could go and buy and own land in Israel, or what was to become Israel. World War I produced the Balfour Declaration, setting aside Palestine specifically as a homeland for the Jew. Now, up to this time, the Jews were saying, oh, it's great to have a homeland now. Especially the wealthy were saying, I am very happy we have a homeland. And as, I'm trying to think of, the Baron Rothschild said, and when we become a nation, I will be most happy to be the ambassador in Paris. But along came the Depression, wiped Jews out like Gentiles. Now what's holding them back? I will send fishers for them, and if they will not come, I will send for many hunters. We have the Depression, and then we have World War II and Adolf Hitler. Remember that guy who came in to establish the Third Reich that would last for 1,000 years, and he only missed it by 988? At any rate, the Jews were driven from Central Europe in World War II. With the East versus West communist problem, there was a lot of problems for the Soviet Union through the Soviet Jewish dissidents. More on that another time. But we've seen with the fall of the Soviet Union a lot of anti-Jewish sentiment there, and over 1 million of the 3 million Jews have already left the Soviet Union. And the Jews are wiser than most other peoples. They send back the youth who are strong enough to rebuild the country, and the old folks that have got the money and they're established, they send money over to fund the youth to rebuild the nation. So that in time, the Jews will die out in the lands of the north, but the nation of Israel will get the benefit. It is a youthful nation compared with most any other nation in the world. That leaves only the major concentration of Jews in the West, and more specifically, the Western part, the Americas. And I would suggest that that is what a depression is likely to cause to happen. And finally, with the Jews having been regathered from the center, from the East and from the West, that sets the stage for Ezekiel 38 and 9, the Gog and Magog invasion. And we will notice that each major world event since our Lord's return has contributed one major step towards the overthrow of Babylon, And also one major step towards the restoration of Israel. What's bad for the one is good for the other. But now, we need to get on to the applications, because head knowledge will not do it for us. Salvation is not by knowledge. That was the concept of the Gnostics, against which we see John in his gospel and in his three epistles is writing against. The doctrine that salvation is by knowledge rather than by faith. Salvation is much more nearly associated with the application of knowledge. And that's what Revelation is telling us. Blessed is he that readeth, and they that hear the words of this prophecy, and keep the things which are written therein. If we understand it correctly, we are getting ready for the depression here, so we are in the last days of Western supremacy. What should we do now? Well, Romans 13:8, owe no man anything but love, kindness. Now, there are four objections that Pharaoh poses in Egypt in connection with these seven last plagues. And of these, the one in chapter 10, verses 10 and 11, seems to be associated with the time that we are living in since World War II. In chapter 10, verses 10 and 11, the essence of it is, let the Lord be so with you as I will let your little ones go. Go ye now that are men, for that ye did desire. And they were driven out from the presence of Pharaoh. What's that telling us? Satan is saying, okay, I'll give in this far. You old geezers can believe the truth all that you want, but no fair teaching it. I am going to take the youth for myself so that when you guys die off, the truth will die off with you. But Moses says, no, that we are required to take all of us before we must go out and do our sacrifice to the Lord our God, and that will be our children as well. We should pursue public witness, and we should pursue personal witness. None of us is exempt from that. Public enemy number one. But we are not yet kept back from sacrifice. Now, if the next world event is a depression, then it continues to be a matter of we should owe no man anything but loving kindness. That we should owe to all. Now, it is likely to happen, if there's another depression, as it did in the first depression, that public opinion will turn against the Jews. If it does, you and I should have nothing to do with that. After all, when things go wrong, a politician has two options: blame himself or blame somebody else. That's what they call a no-brainer. And who usually gets the blame? Yes, the Jews. And so if and when that time comes that public opinion turns against the Jews, we should have no part of being against the Jews. Do not join in. Now at that time, the last of Pharaoh's four objections will presumably kick in, because that's the way it's shown. And that is, okay, you can all of you go now, only let your cattle and your herds be stayed behind, your flocks and your herds. In other words, all of you can go believe the truth all you want, but I'm not going to let you sacrifice. That may mean because case of depression that the government will see the only way out is to seize whatever belongs to anyone. And one of the former presidents said, a government that is big enough to give you everything you want is big enough to take everything you've got. But we might not at that time be kept back from personal witness and from helping and encouraging the children. So these are the things that we should do during this period of the harvest of two vines, during the period of the harvest of the true vine. Emphasize, we should do everything that we can to owe no man anything but love, and that really means two things for each of us. Get out of debt and stay out of debt. Sacrifice may become the target, so let's do what we can while we still can. And I think the time is up, so this is the place where we have to stop.